So today we have a great opportunity to hear Walid Beshti discuss his work in depth with the Hirschhorn's curator, Evelyn Hankins. Evelyn curated Walid's direction exhibition, Legibility on Color Backgrounds. The show will run in the museum on the third floor from April 30th, yesterday, to September 13th, and we are really very excited to have this exhibition here. It's beautiful, and I'm sure that many of you have seen it, and you who haven't, please go and look at it. Let me tell you something about few things about Walid. Walid Beshti was born in London, and is an artist and writer living and working in Los Angeles. Beshti holds BA from Bard College and an MFA from Yale University School of Art. His work has recently been shown in several prestigious venues: Kunsthalle Basel, the 2008 Whitney Biennale in Whitney Museum of American Art in New York, the Renaissance Society in Chicago, Armand Hammer Museum of Art in Los Angeles, and Wall Space in New York. His work is also in many collections, including the Whitney Museum, the Guggenheim Museum in New York, and the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles. He is a member of the faculty of the Graduate Fine Art Program at Art Center College of Art and Design in Pasadena, California. Well, they are both here, Walid and Evelyn, so let's welcome them and give them the floor. Thank you.
So thank you, Milena. We've decided that we're going to have a conversation about Walid's work, and we're going to open up the floor to questions after we have our conversation. First, I'd like to thank Walid, who is here today and has been in D.C. now for 2 weeks, patiently installing his exhibition. Since the beginning of this project, he has been committed to creating a really amazing project here, and his vision and that commitment has really made it an extraordinary process of working together. So I just want to thank Walid and really acknowledge the tremendous effort that he's put into this show.
Thank you for having
me. So I thought the way I'd like to start this is talk about how I came about inviting Walid to do a show here. I first saw Walid's work the fall of 2006. It was a show in New York at his gallery in Wall Space. And it was this really interesting show that had works in a variety of media. It had these very kind of alluring photograms, these black and white photograms. It had sculptures, it had photographs. Some of the interesting works that really caught my eye were a reproduction of Le Corbusier's famous club chair. And instead of having the beautiful kind of aluminum tubing that those pieces are known for, they were made out of Home Depot parts. And it was really kind of a comment on the irony or the contradiction of Le Corbusier, who was a very ardent supporter of democratic design, but he created these pieces and these villas that were very much for a very elite population. There was also another sculpture there, which is a play on Man Ray's famous sculpture, New York. The original was a clamp holding a bunch of several pieces of metal together, and in Walid's piece, it was all made in gold, and he doubled the two art elements to create somewhat of a piece of architecture. The works that caught my eye most were these photograms. And a photogram, if many of you don't know, is a photographic process that does not involve a camera. And it was really embraced by the early 20th century European modernist people such as Rodchenko, Christian Schad, Man Ray, and Moholy Nagy. And Walid, however, took some of the very essential elements of the photogram process, the possibility of chance, and framed them in a really interesting way that updated the photographic process to pose questions about the medium of photography and some of our conventional notions about how it's a medium based on mimetic representation. And the show sat in my mind for about a year until I eventually made my way to LA and we did a studio visit last year, or I guess it was January 2008. And there he showed me more recent bodies of photograms, as well as glass sculptures, paper pulp sculptures, and this amazing floor piece, which you'll see images of later. So my thought was is that I was interested in his work because Walid, to me, seems like one of a number of younger artists who are approaching modernism in a very different way. modernism has been fodder for artists for decades now, whether it be the postmodernists looking at it ironically, or everybody's always taking on Greenberg's formalism in a very kind of critical way. And Walid's work, it seemed, was looking at modernism and some of its most essential premises in a critical way, but it wasn't to critique modernism necessarily, but it seemed to be tweaking it. And I've been struggling with this for a while now, and I still haven't found a way to describe your work or set off that group of artists, and that'll be an article somewhere down the line. But to me, it seemed like the type of work that would be appropriate for the Hirshhorn. Here at the museum, we are grappling with a continuum of art that leads all the way back to Daumier and Aikens, but I like to think of us as a continuum between 20th and 21st century art, and how do you create a dialogue for that? So Walid, to me, seemed like an artist who was creating interesting work that would fit really well in our Directions Gallery, which, as many of you know, is situated on the third floor amidst our permanent collection. So that's how this process started, and I invited him to create this show, and it was very much a collaboration, as all shows are, but it was much more so, because Walid, like most artists, has very specific ideas about how his work should be shown, and I have to say I learned a lot about not only his work, but it made me reconsider some of my own thoughts about modernism during the process. So Walid, I'd like you to start talking about it, if you would, how you embraced the photogram and what made you start working with that process.
And I should probably skip ahead and sort of show these three pieces. And these were called pictures made by my hand with the assistance of light. And actually, it's funny. I was thinking about how to the show that I had right before this was at the Hammer Museum, and it involved a very complicated sort of scenario around the Iraqi embassy to the former DDR, and it produced a kind of question for me, which seemed like a kind of impasse in contemporary photography, which was that the conventions around contemporary photography seemed really fixed, specifically around pictorial types of images, pictorial Renaissance perspective, those types of representations. And I had, it's a two-part story, but the first part was I ended up going out and having drinks with Moholy Nagy's grandson, who he has a gallery in LA, and we got. And he asked me, well, why does contemporary photography, why is it so boring? Why is it so bad? And I said, well, I don't really know. But I had been thinking about this, why hadn't during the early avant-gardes, or, you know, the Weimar avant-gardes, why hadn't somebody made a materialist photograph? It seems like something somebody would do, you know, that... You know, Rodchenko made his last paintings then. There was all this sort of the anti-retinal in terms of Duchamp, or the sort of mistrust of pictorial images. And it seemed as though that at that point, someone would have made a crumpled paper photogram. And he goes, oh, Moholy did it. And so we ended up getting progressively drunker and drunker and sort of inventing this whole sort of context for this body of work. And it turns out the work never was made. We figured out when it would be made, right when Moholy Nagy moved and changed his name and moved to Berlin so that it would be made at around 21, 22. But it turns out that this was an apocryphal story, and I had sort of hunted him down to try to find out, he runs the estate and everything, and to try to find out where this work was, because I was quite curious about it. I mean, it seemed like something that was a sort of option that hadn't been pursued. So it turns out it didn't exist, but that kind of prompted me, this sort of missing piece, and it seemed like a missing piece in terms of a history, and it also solved a bunch of problems that I felt like I was confronted with in photography. In particular, my teachers were, probably the person who had a major early influence on me was a teacher of mine, Stephen Shore, and I loved his work, and it seemed like a lot of, and I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, but it was large format, sort of photographs of mostly depopulated urban settings, also very sort of still, kind of austere portraits that look quite a bit, had a strong influence of Neue Sachlichkeit photography. Early, you know, like 20s, 30s, German photography was sort of very strong within his work. And this, thinking about this, gave me a kind of option out of that history. While I really respected that work a lot, it was a question of how to continue from that point. So the photograms in particular, and these, I built all the frames myself. So there was something about, and they're horrible frames. I mean, they're very wonky. I know nothing about how to make a frame. And it was about reverse engineering the frames, making everything At least in relationship to the photograms, everything that was at immediately at hand, the paper's crumpled. And what happens is the paper itself acts as almost its own negative. It casts an image of itself onto itself. So that you have a literal topography, the paper is quite rumpled, you have a literal topography that's produced by the crumples, and then you also have an image of the paper on the paper. So it seemed to solve this kind of problem about always photographs always being about some place else or something else, never really looking at the object, but only looking at it as a window to another location. And so that's sort of how photograms began for me. And I learned not to make my frames ever again. But these are some of them. So you can kind of see, I mean, it's hard when you don't see the object, but you know, it's hard to tell sort of how the actual topography works. But you can see there's kind of curling on the side there. So it's a way to take image and material and allow them to kind of coexist, you know, more or less. This is similar to some of the works that are upstairs. It's actually from the same series. And I began making folded paper works. And how I would set that up is, and I don't mean to just continue
that's
on.
Fine. If it, that's fine. I'll tell you margins.
I just slip into autopilot.
Ben.
But these were made, I started getting really intrigued with this idea of you know, what, to pursue this sort of, this as an option for practice. And one thing that sort of also sort of frustrated me is that there was a sense that, you know, despite the sort of work in photograms and Bauhaus and also in Dada, that it was largely talked about as an experiment. And I didn't want these to be sort of experimental examples, that I wanted them to be a viable option for production and also for them to be relatively transparent in terms of how they were made. So that there's a kind of stupidity to this work too. You know, it's a sort of photo one exercise. You go in the dark room, you play with the paper, you know, and there was a sort of a simplicity to it that was really important to me, that there was no sort of mysteriousness about how it was produced. You know, and most photography at that, when I'm thinking about what I was looking at a lot, was Dusseldorf photography, people like Gursky or Ruf or Struth. I think Jerry Saltz coined the term Strusky, which right. I thought was pretty amazing, or Axel Hütte, et cetera. And what it seemed to me those reproduced was photographs as this sort of monolithic and also completely alienating kind of object, that in some sense the production of the thing was withheld, that it always required this massive sort of apparatus behind the scenes in order to produce the thing. And I wanted it, the scale of the production, despite the literal scale of the work, that the scale of the production be simple, you know, that it be sort of everything that be immediately at hand. And I had been working digitally before this point, but again, it felt like that was sort of foreclosed or sort of, there weren't that many options left in it for me.
Can I barge in here and ask a question? Can you talk about the scale of your works? Because when I think of the modernist precedents, they are small handhold objects, and part of that is because you hear these, again, apocryphal stories about Moholy Nagy and Man Ray working in the hotel room, especially with Man Ray. There's this story about Man Ray, you know, making all of these photograms in his hotel room with whatever objects happen to be around. And you think of them as a very intimate, almost a domestic scale, and Moholy Nagy, though his aesthetic is very different, has that same kind of scale. And you talk about the Dusseldorf school and the difference between the scale of your works and the scale of production, but can you talk about the scale of the photograms? Because, I mean, they are incredibly striking on this large scale, and talk about how that relates a bit.
My work, and maybe this is somewhat arbitrary or not immediately apparent, but it's all scaled based on my body. I mean, the thing is that I have to negotiate with these things in the dark. And that's where some of the absurdity comes from. And it's also where some of the physical distress that you see on the surface of the paper is, you know, especially with color, which has to be produced in total darkness. There's no safe light for color. Well, there's amber, but it doesn't really work. You're not supposed to use it, really. But there's not really a safe light for color. And so it's stumbling around in the dark with this sheet of paper. And how the large ones are scaled is basically I stand up, and then I extend my arms above my head, and that becomes the scale of the work. Initially, that was the premise as well. With the crumple pieces, one of the ideas, the titling that came out of, we reconstructed a Moholy Nagy type of title, which were always long, verbose, and sort of seemed to cascade. And there are pictures made by my hand with the assistance of light, that there would always be a bodily scalar built in. So in every case, it's somehow measured off my body, because precise measurements otherwise were sort of impossible. And that was sort of part of using myself also as like a tool within the process, that I became another dumb machine. Once I got in the darkroom, I was blind. It was really just about maneuvering. You know, it was really just about trying to get control over the situation, which sort of extends to how these are made in a sense, or how the forms turn out, because they're, what I would do is fold them into a freestanding sort of largely geometric form, and it would have to stand on its own, and then it's exposed to different degrees of light. So the light would be positioned at one angle and then another angle that would describe this three-dimensional form onto the surface of the paper.
Might be nice to go through and show some of the other examples.
So this is another work like that.
Oh, and one of the things I was intrigued about when I was in Walid's studio was him telling me the story of making freestanding sculptures. And I imagined him in the darkroom. And what I was intrigued by is photograms, as I said, are a medium that are because of the way they are created in the total darkness, the fact that you don't actually see the image until after it's been developed, are very inherently based on chance. And so I was interested in this way that Walid, on one hand, sets up a set of parameters or rules or systems around the work, but then at the same time is really relying on chance. And can you talk about those two and how they play together?
Because it's a nice segue to the Salt-Lewitt,
because it's the same thing with LeWitt.
Yeah. And this is actually, I believe it's wall drawing 260 from 75. I might be wrong.
Right, because we didn't have an image this morning. We couldn't get an image fast enough of ours.
But this is actually the work, it's at MoMA, and I used to visit it all the time. And there was something about, in particular, this Salt-Lewitt, but, you know, and you have number two?
Three.
Which is pretty amazing. But that I would stand in front of it, and it would sort of have that overwhelming, all-over kind of Abex painting quality, that it had that sort of rush, that sort of, you know, intoxicating sort of, and also kind of detached, that sort of elated sensation. But at the same time, it didn't conceal its means of production. In other words, you know, that LeWitt always put, you know, has the key next to it, so that when these sort of compositional moves, these really intoxicating sort of graphic elements of the work were operating, that it was always completely transparent as to how it was made, that it was open, that it was a very generous piece. So it didn't sacrifice a sense of, it didn't sacrifice beauty or that immersion, but at the same time, it didn't trade on this idea that of a private space of the artist, you know, a sort of concealment of, you know, how did that shape get there? And that was something that really sort of, it was a high watermark for me, because in a lot of senses it seemed to get around what I felt like was a central political problem with aesthetics, is that one of the ways that power functions as realized through aesthetics, or in most cases, is that it conceals how it self-exoticizes. It makes itself, it's self-validating. And that there was a sense that here, it wasn't just that you could have that overwhelming experience, that sort of sense of sort of, you know, elation or whatever, but that it also was completely transparent, that it didn't need to disguise how it was made. And I think one of those ways is that art maybe performs in that sort of disguising is by concealing, you know, where the artist's choices come from or how. So the producing based on systems was in a way to get away from that kind of compositional power, that sort of, that my touch would become somehow erratic or special. And what I was interested in is that this could be kind of an open, kind of, when I say dumb process, that's what I mean, that it's open, that it's available, that anybody could really try to make things in that vein.
Right.
Not the same things, but that it's a kind of tool.
Right, and at the same time, is that if anyone's looked at the checklist that's in the gallery, you'll see that Walid's titles reveal the very circumstances of the production. You know it's by Walid, but it talks about, in the case of the folded pieces, how many folds it was, the different angles of light that were projected onto it, the date of the production, where it was produced, what kind of paper it was produced because of the material circumstances of that. And that very much is, again, this kind of revealing of the creation of the piece and kind of demystifying this role of the artist, I think.
Also transparency to the point of absurdity, I think,
I will
sometimes,
say that. Yeah, definitely. I think our exhibits department would agree.
While didactics become problematic.
So let's talk about how you then did you move into color photograms, because of course the other thing was that Moholy Nagy never made color photograms, that he experimented with color photography.
I started thinking about how color would work in, and basically using a similar kind of premise. I actually started making color photograms before I made those black and white folded pieces. It just sort of thematically fit to transition that way. But these are made, again, by folding them into a freestanding form that could stand on its own. And in that sense, the weight of the paper, you know, the size of the paper, it behaves differently at different sizes. It can sustain more of its own weight at different scales. So that would be a large part of how the form of the thing was determined. And then each side got a color, cyan, magenta, yellow, or red, green, blue. The ICs in red, green, blue cones, but all reflected light is CMY, which is why the printed page is done with CMY and K, which is black. But these are some of those works. And I'll just go on and
talk?
And these are related to the works that are upstairs, and these are the works upstairs are six color curls, and these are three color curls, and these are made just with cyan, magenta, and yellow. And you can see at the intersection of the different colors that that's where you get blue. So when magenta and cyan cross, you get a blue. So cyan, magenta, and yellow are enough to make the full color spectrum. And these are just curled on the wall, and then recurled between every exposure to light. And again, it's done in total darkness. But it was a way to just to let the flow and the sort of gravity on the paper dictate how the forms were sort of going to be transcribed. You can see in the top right corner, there's sort of a curl from the edge of the paper as it sort of as it hung down.
I mean, and we should mention, I don't think we mentioned that you work with industrial rolls of photo paper. So unlike the photo paper that you get on the small scale that comes in those nice little boxes, it's already curled, and that's where the curling is coming from. So when he hangs it up on the wall, the paper's curling back on itself from its being curled on the roll the whole time.
It really is slapstick. I'm usually covered in sweat and cursing and just trying to get out, really. It often takes up to, you know, an hour and a half to 2 hours while I'm making them.
I mean, this leads into something that, again, that I think is interesting in Wally's work. It's this kind of tension between instrumentality and chance that we kind of touched on earlier. But this is a piece that you might want to talk about, this about that takes the photograms and moves them into the digital realm.
Yeah, I had been thinking about what would be a sort of an analogous or a sort of complementary sort of a way to deal with the materiality of a digital image, and that it couldn't be addressed in the same way that the materiality of, say, photo paper or photograph could be dealt with. And what I had sort of happened into was I would take, digital files are essentially text. You know, it just depends what application is interpreting that text or that data. And to take a digital file and put it into a word processing program or I use TextEdit because actually Microsoft Word adds too much metadata to it. But and to treat an image as a piece of text and to use standard language-based functions within the word processing program to modify that text. So that it essentially created another set of rules, but this time determined by the word processing program. And I would do things like spell check or rewrap text. And what that did was it altered the way that the data was organized. And when it was put back into a program that looked for an image, looked for a digital file that was actually an image, what it did was it screwed up the registration of, you know, and also the colors that were being shown. And it's sort of hard to explain, it's a little abstract, but basically it was another kind of chance process that to me spoke to how a digital file was organized, that it was basically organized on a Cartesian grid parallel with the surface of, say, your computer or a piece of paper, and that coordinate plane was sort of revealed in a sense, and some of how the image was sort of constructed digitally was revealed by working in that way, much in the same sense that allowing the photographic paper to be a generator of both image and a receiver of image functioned in terms of the photograms.
And I think this is a good place to talk about something that we're going to move from the photograms onto the sculptures and some of the other works, but to talk about this tension between formalism and conceptualism or conceptual paradigms in your work. When I see Walid's photographs, especially, I'm really drawn to them. They're absolutely gorgeous, and I react to them on an aesthetic basis. But they are actually really savvy and really smart as well, and they're clearly driven by this really very strong conceptual underpinning. Could you talk about that tension and how that plays? And I was struck the other day how we were having a conversation and someone called you a formalist and you embraced it. And I think the person who was saying it was saying it in a somewhat derogatory way, and it makes me think of people like Joseph Kossuth, who we had here last year, who is a conceptual artist of a much older generation, who swore after going through 30, 40 slides of his projects, all of which were extremely beautiful, were photographed absolutely beautiful, and swore at the end that he was not interested in formal things or aesthetics. And it seems to me, I'd like to hear about how the two of them relate in your work, and especially this idea that you embrace the fact that being a formalist isn't such a horrible thing after all.
How I end up getting there, or how I end up thinking about it, is that there's a set of systems or forms that define the appearance of things within the world anyway, and that, I mean, those systems extend, you know, they can be social or economic or there's a multitude of these kinds of structures. I mean, I guess in terms of a basic opposition between a formalism and a conceptualism, I don't really see there. I guess that's part of it, is I don't see there a real opposition between the two, because, you know, conceptual art was always manifest in objects, and there was a care and specificity in terms of how the objects manifested themselves. You know, a Robert Barry photograph of the inert gas series, you know, or you know, Hamish Fulton, or whomever you might want to draw into that. You know, I think that there was always a strong formal sense that permeated that work, but more so, I mean, I think, you know, there is I'm interested in the politics associated with aesthetics. In other words, how aesthetics define one's relationship to things. And I think that that's not immaterial. And one of the problems that I always had with photographs is that they were treated the same regardless of scale, right? So you have a photograph, say, in a magazine or on a billboard, and that even though the deployment of this thing and the way that it spoke to a public or to an audience was completely different, it spoke in a different tongue, it had a different kind of power associated with it, it had a different function, that these things were treated as the same image. And for me, the reason why formalism maybe is important or materialism is important is that it's the specific condition of the object that I think defines the situation around it. And that effect, but I don't know if that really does that address.
No, it answers it. I mean, I think I think it's a lot of this is about a generation change and your approach to modernism and your approach to conceptual premises. The two are no longer, it's no longer a critique. Like, conceptual art was a critique of formal premises or aesthetics and certain, you know, a generation of painters before them. And it's now 40 years later, and I think it's more your generation of artists has moved on from that and are able to pull them back together.
Well, I think it's also just solving problems. I mean, I think that conceptual artists were trying to solve problems about the way that art objects spoke to a public, spoke to an audience, and tried to change the level of participation and also the access that they had. I mean, people talk about conceptual art as though it's elitist. And really, on the other hand, it dealt with print media. It circulated widely. I mean, when you talk about magazine pieces and things like that, that you know, like, say, Hubler's Walks, like the schematic that you could then follow, the way that it was, you know, Lawrence Wiener, I mean, the way that all the procedures were wide open, it actually was a democratization of aesthetic practice. You didn't have to be it could show how the whole process happened, and it acted almost like an invitation, and it accepted that social element, whereas, say, the conventional model of a painter in the studio, again, it was not public, and I think they made a lot of those actions, those activities, public. So there's a funny way that becoming public and becoming pared down, you know, somehow translated into it being elitist in some sense. And I never really understood it in that way. And maybe that's where I see them as a formalism and that moving together.
Not necessarily opposing one another.
Because I see the systems that maybe would happen in, like, or someone like Mel Bochner or whatever, you know, measurements, those systems are form. You know,
right.
That's an organizational form that's present in the aesthetics of this room or whatnot.
Right.
You know,
and I think what's also interesting about your work is with its conceptual premises, you do lay out these systems or these rules, but there's a much more playful approach to them. I mean, people always talk about the conceptual artists all broke their own rules when it became convenient, but you don't even, I mean, one of the things that we did during this installation, this will get us onto the glass boxes, is that we were trying to figure out the installation of how to line the boxes up, and Walid had certain parameters as to where they were to be placed, but we were trying to figure out how to install them and arrange them, and it turned into this game where he made a move and decided where a box would be moved, and then I would make a move. I'm not allowed to touch the objects and decide.
They always kind of looked like chess pieces. I mean,
they did.
Chess,
it became a chess game. We were back to Duchamp again, of course. But what I thought was so interesting is that it got to a certain point where, like, well, are we done? Yeah, I think we're done. And there was no. It wasn't. And I felt like we were breaking our rules. We invited other people to come in, and it was a much more fluid, and the system was there, but it was a much more open system. And that, to me, I think, again, is a reflection of a change in the culture and how we approach this kind of art, and clearly how you view it. I'd like to talk about the FedEx boxes a bit.
You can move to another image.
First of all, I'm interested, I mean, I was thinking the other day as I was standing in front of one of your photograms, well, what is the relationship between your sculpture and your photography? And, you know, I mean, there's clearly conceptual ties, but then I was standing in front of one of the photograms the other day, the folded ones, and it was so sculptural, and I had thought, oh, he didn't really make sculpture until he started making these and the paper pulp pieces, which recycle photograms that he's decided not to put out into the public.
Yeah, I ended up wasting so much paper that they're called selected works, and they're just bricks of trashed work that I didn't like. I mean, both photograms and I realized I was holding on to all this stuff that I didn't really feel okay with throwing away because it was so wasteful and didn't want to show either.
Could you talk about the FedEx boxes and how they came into being and how they do relate to the photographic work? I mean, you're not a photographer, and I think that's a label that I, for one, was able to put on you, but clearly you've been doing sculptures for a while. But the relationship between how you came to start doing these FedEx boxes?
The two things that it started with was I had a show in Berlin, and there was no budget, but there was a FedEx account number. And I had to figure out how to do the shows at a public space that was connected to the Volksbühne, which is like a, you know, an East German kind of opera house, and they had this little beautiful little glass pavilion next to it. And I had also been thinking about, well, one of the problems with the photograms to me was that the process seemed to stop, that there was a kind of variability and a set of conditions that were static until the thing was made, and then it was over. And I was thinking about, was there a way to open that up? And I was also thinking about, and it's funny because you're showing a Jon Bach piece now, but I saw a Jon Bach, a little drawing collage at MoMA, and I had seen it a few years earlier, 5 years earlier in Berlin, and what struck me was how the object had transformed. I mean, it looked kind of off-handed, and it had this sort of this rawness to it when I had first seen it. And then when I saw it in MoMA, it had this sort of authority and this sort of, it just felt completely different. And I was thinking about, well, was there a possibility for an art object that actually, as it moved through conditions, as it moved through different contexts, that it would materially change at the same time? So, I mean, that's where the sort of, the initial rule with these pieces, which is that they always ship within the same box, and they traffic, so they can't be shown unless they've trafficked. So the next place that they go, wherever they go, it has to go through FedEx. So the only way to destroy the work is really to try to conserve it, you know, for a museum to put it in a crate and you know, try to repair and all that kind of stuff. But it really came out of this an interest in to make a work that had an allowance for the continued variability and had a life, and that life would be built back into the form of the thing as time went on. So that was the basic thing. The other thing is there was a real perversity. I found out that FedEx owned, basically when you have international shippers, their boxes are SSCC coded, so DHL, UPS, you know, whatnot. SSCC coding means that it's basically a proprietary volume. So it wasn't just that FedEx owned the copyright on the box or the tube, but it was that they owned that volume of space. No, DHL couldn't come out with a box that was exactly the same size as the FedEx large box. If you look at them, they mirror each other a little bit, UPS, DHL, and FedEx, but that they're slightly different. And that's because FedEx actually owns that volume, and that was proprietary. And that seemed like a really funny idea in relationship to, say, minimalism and modularity and sort of a grid structure, right? A modular grid structure that was based on intellectual property of a corporation. And, you know, I wonder how much of that really, you know, happens with it when looking at the piece. But that was another thing that really struck me about it was the idea of space being owned and to use that kind of space as a condition of the work. I think click through some of these as you're talking.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think this is a good way to think about, to segue into this, but one of the ways that Wally's work is often spoken about is as an institutional critique, and I am guilty of this as well, mostly when talking about as we were getting ready to install the show, because we were getting our boundaries pushed in certain ways. But the work itself, I mean, and, you know...
I love institutions.
We love to push the boundaries of institutions. But, I mean, you know, you can see the you know, I'm listening to people in the galleries and people walking by or people talking about your work, they ask about, you know, well, is the use of the FedEx box a critique of the commodification of artwork or anything like that? And the work, to me, doesn't... That part of your work doesn't talk about institutional critique, but I think it does bring to bear the point about how institutional critique may or may not relate to your work and how you see your work positioned towards that idea.
I mean, a lot of artists, particularly Michael Asher, who are associated with institutional critique, had a major impact on me, but I think I wouldn't use that term in relationship to his work, because in a lot of ways that category sort of limits. I don't think it was a war against the institution in any sense, and it's sort of what I was kind of thinking of, you know, both with FedEx and also, I mean, I didn't show images here, but the use of x-rays and sort of travel to in part to make work, and in this piece, which was it's untitled, it's just called Floor, and then it's with the location of the floor, but was to use the institution or the site of viewership, you know, that the exhibition space is also a site of production. It's where viewers sort of, it's where the work lives, right? And art objects only exist when they're put into social traffic, when they're discussed, when they move around. And that maybe, I mean, is also something for me that comes from Duchamp too, which, like, with the ready-made, I don't really think of it as low to high or high to low. I don't think it's that simple. I think it was more so about the social agreement to discuss something as an aesthetic object, to discuss something as an art object, and that the life of that work was really about placing the emphasis on the frame, and the frame is people or individuals moving around and discussing things or, you know, sharing ideas and whatnot. So, I mean, this piece in particular, this was at LAX Art in Los Angeles, and this was a floor, and again, it's installed, you know, unbroken, of course. It's a double-paned architectural grade mirror glass. And as the space is sort of used and walked through, it slowly cracks based on the movement of the people in the space, so that there would be not only to sort of cast an image of the, you know, to double the exhibition site. And it does nice for filling in all the light, too. But also that image would slowly change over the course of the show, and that the participants were almost like the engine within the work. You know, that the movement, that the life of the work was again directly built into the mechanism of it. That it was about that sort of accumulation over time. These are just a couple details of it. I just like that V shape. That was an unexpected light effect. And this is it ran into the office and the sort of transitory spaces. And actually, this was supposed to be installed at LACMA, but it kind of hit the skids, not for any sort of public safety reason, but because people were worried that it would encourage peeping Toms to stare up other people's skirts.
Are you kidding me?
That was the deal breaker.
That is a public safety, though. That is
They're
a public
like, well,
safety
you know,
issue.
People will wear skirts. And I tried to show them. I was like, no, wear a skirt. I'll show you. You can't. So there's this very funny, almost private self-inspection. Like, when you're standing, I mean, it's really horrible to look at yourself from that perspective, too. All I could see was, like, my gut sort of hanging over there. I was like, it's bad for everyone, but no one else sees it. Anyway, so this is just another detail of it. And those are the x-ray photographs that just pass through x-ray machines when I travel. And it's sort of related to the earlier work that I showed at the Hammer. I'm not sure how you want to segue into this.
I don't know how I want to segue. I think what we're going to do is, we can talk about two things. We can either talk about the portraits or your installation here. We're running low on time, but I think what I'd like to talk about then more is the installation here. When you walk into the gallery here. On one hand, it's a little bit of a confusing space. On one hand, it's a conventional white cube, and you walk in, and there's a series of discrete objects. There's the front wall piece. There's a series of portraits that are scattered throughout the gallery. There are black and white photograms. There are sculptures. These are examples of the portraits he takes.
I should put you up first.
Yeah, that would be really nice. That got taken out of the show. That's a little curatorial prerogative. It was a negotiation rather than a collaboration, I should say. But when you walk into a series of discrete objects, on the other hand, you know, and it conforms to basic conventions of modern display. But what I also find interesting about the space is that none of the objects are hung where you would expect them to be. And this is something that's developed relatively recently in Waleed's practice. And I was hoping he would explain not only his interest in display and how he's installing works these days, but also talk about specifically how he came about installing the show here as he did, because it took a couple days. We were a couple days into installation, and before we really kind of came up with the premise of it, I felt like we were headed in a very different direction. Mm-hmm. So if you talk about that a bit.
I mean, I think, maybe it makes sense to show this show, and this was a show that I just had at Wall Space in New York. And I had built this L-shaped wall in the middle of the space, and the space was sort of a square, and squares are difficult, or at least I had always been told that. And I'd gotten increasingly frustrated with the idea of, you know, you walk into an exhibition and you kind of go, oh, that feels right there, and that feels right there, and that sort of arbitrary sort of tastefulness, which wasn't really an interesting, you know, it's just not interesting for me to sort of engage with that, and I don't mind when people do it, but I needed something else to keep me engaged with the process of installation. And this show, I won't get into it too much, but there was a system about the installation where I based a scalar off the height of the walls, and there was a spacing, and all of the pieces, all of my work can, or at least the photograms, can also go sideways. They have no top or bottom. They sort of rotate, because there's no top or bottom when I'm making them. So, and I like that variability in terms of if someone wants to install them in a different way or use them in a different way, which is the same for the FedEx pieces, that the work allows for that, that it's open to that, and that seeing these other kinds of applications of the work is sort of important for me. So this was sort of based around this spiral of this square room, and so this is one view, and so all the work in it was scaled, and there was a kind of cadence that was maintained by having a sort of rule for how the installation would proceed, and it also produced surprises. I mean, somebody said, "Oh, that's such a nice gesture that you have that piece hanging off the wall," and it was just a clash between this rule system that I worked out and then the shortness of this wall, which I guess I didn't really think ahead of time. I didn't realize that was the rule I was going to generate on site. And that was a sort of point of this friction where the rule kind of steps forward, that like one of the procedures or one of the explanations for how the space sort of functioned was manifest in this collision, you know, that happened between this one piece of the architecture and one of the works. So this is just sort of spirals around. You can sort of see how it worked out. And with the Hirshhorn, I was pretty, you know, I was fascinated by the building. I think Bunschaft's building is kind of amazing. And first off, because it's a massive oculus with a sun in the center of it, and there's the Smithsonian's sort of insignia, the sun shape, and that it was an eye, but it was an eye that looked inward, you know, that all the windows kind of turn inward towards this sun. The other thing is that most art objects are produced on Cartesian grids, right? Flat works, you know, they're all gridded systems, paintings, whatnot. You know, very few kind of curved works. Maybe Charlie Ray's curved wall, but it's sort of all about that. So there are very few curved art objects. And that what I realized that the Bunschaft building did, and this had been also a concern of mine, sort of making the photograms too, was he I think, really polemically pointed out this sort of tension between the perceptual space, you know, one sees in curved space because your eye is, you know, the lens of your eye is curved. So actually you don't have infinitely diverging, you know, lines. You have, you know, every line that's parallel actually curves in onto itself. You know, so you really see in a sequence of sections of circles, if I'm making myself, if that makes any sense. So that's why, you know, they would, you know, Ionic columns and stuff like that, they would bend them to try to compensate for the way your eye sees. And that to go off the grid and to create these curved walls talked about this tension between perceptual space and a gridded structure that happens in most exhibition spaces, right? That the most exhibition spaces are based on grids as well. And I thought that it was really kind of amazing. So one of the, here are some Alberti diagrams, which I'm not, I don't, there's no need to. This is from Panofsky's perspective as symbolic form, but you can kind of see that. He's talking about the distinction between curved space and a sort of Renaissance perspectively regular space. And so this is the overview of the Directions Gallery. And what I ended up working out was a kind of, I based this T-wall off a, and I based a grid off the T-wall. This is just useful because it shows the distortion between a curved and a linear, how the spread happens. And what I ended up doing was using the line of the T-wall as defining an edge of this grid, and using that grid to project the placement of works on the wall. So it would get skewed because of this interaction between the grid structure and the curved space. So I don't know. I mean, it's probably more useful if I stand up. But so there would be a placement of works off of this T, and then where the works reflected, it would go from, say, either the curve here or the curved wall here. And then that would get transcribed back onto the grid. So it was this mirroring back and forth between a grid as an organizational system and a circle as an organizational system. And that also dictated the starting point for the boxes, that they were all also fixed on that same grid. So that to have this kind of premise or this kind of logical structure that directly kind of clashed with, not clash, but sort of had a friction or a kind of would resonate maybe with the architecture, with the confines of the architecture, and that all my work is rectangular or gridded as well, and to sort of try to deal with that in terms of the space that you walked into. I'm not sure if that.
I mean, I think that's a good explanation. I think again, it's one of these examples, and for me though, I mean, ultimately we would laser level these things and put them in these places, and then we would look at each other and go, well, how does it look? And for me, that kind of brought the tension back that you can never really get back to get away from taste, because the two, you and I, are both working within the same conventions of what looks good and what doesn't. And for the most part, it stayed within that system. But there were a lot of moments in the gallery, at least what I was thinking was that, oh, well, we're working with this system, but ultimately, does this system work for us in our own eyes, as socially constructed as they are? And I found that to be really interesting.
It's not so much though that taste it comes back to the other thing that was happening with the photograms is that I got kind of in trouble, I guess, when I'm going to repeat the problem again. I'm going to sort of extend what I got in trouble for before. But in relationship to the LAX show, someone had asked me, and then I'm getting quoted in a review that appeared in Freeze. For some reason, it was the most interesting thing I said, that it was fine with me that my work would look good over a couch. And so, of course, that gets quoted, and then, you know, whatever. But, you know, that the seduction or the sort of, you know, that a seduction with a thing and attractiveness, how it gets put to use, it should, an art object should sort of accept these things and be specific about how it accepts them. And for me, the question of taste, while on some level unavoidable, can also be transparent. It can have, you know, there is a certain kind of transparency here where there's like a structure that can be sensed in terms of how the room works out. And if one wants to find out how that structure or how that taste functions, say, that it's apparent. And instead of making taste something that's just the you know, within the sort of domain of the studied, you know, sort of, you know, that there could be just like a system that could explain how things were made. So not just, oh, well, it looks good there. Well, though, why? And does one sense these kinds of proportions? You know, does when something works, is there a kind of explanation for, well, why does that feel right in that circumstance? Or, you know, or with the photograms, I mean, there's, like I said, I mean, I keep using the word dumb, and probably that's not a good idea, but there's a kind of dumb process there that produces these outcomes that I get involved with and I find attractive or seductive. And it's funny that something so basic and so sort of limited can produce something that also has a kind of aesthetic engagement to it. And that's probably the thing that surprises me, you know, when I try to work things out this way, is that sometimes it works.
Well, I'd like to open up the floor to questions, if people have any questions. Absolute radio silence. You scared them. You don't have any questions?
I already called myself dumb, so you don't have to.
Oh, Either one.
Oh, there's a microphone back.
Is this work? Okay. Well, I have a dumb question too. The colorgrams, would you expose them to colored light? Is that how you did it, or would it be colored?
Yeah,
film?
It's colored light.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But it's all internal, you know. Color enlargers have filter packs in them, they call it. So it's all internal to the machine that's used. I don't go out and buy gels and put it in front or anything.
Sorry, did you have a question?
Oh, do you?
Yeah. I was just wondering about this first explanation I've ever heard about conceptual art being as open as you say, and really it's a brand new thing for me to look at it that way, but I was just wondering in terms of it, of your explanation of that openness that the art is an elitist, is still in that context of educated mind knowing those things that the public, when confronted with minimalism from the 60s, were probably kind of as baffled as they were when they saw abstract expressionism in terms of being art. And what art is, and the public is still kind of like culturally deprived in those areas of your conversation here today, just so far over a lot of people's heads in this country today. It's still we exist in a small space of who knows about art. And I was wondering in your comments, and like, is it getting tighter that way in terms of, you know, an audience for art.
The question of who's my audience in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, is it the Hirshhorn is like a great public service in terms of educating people in terms of what art is, but I'm just thinking that the academic community, especially the minimalists back in the 60s, were all graduates. The education was becoming more and more prevalent in terms of how smart people were in approaching the art field back then. And I'm just wondering how far askew are we from communicating to regular people. And in terms of your art right here, I see that it's a valid thing in terms of your, you know, evolving people in the process of making the art.
Mm-hmm. I think the question of the part, how much a viewer understands about the procedure creating the thing, I see it a little bit like, I don't know, I take aspirin. I don't know how to make it, but I use it, and I can get something out of it. And then there's a rarefied discourse around the production of, you know, pharmaceuticals and construction and everything else. And then I can. There's also an invitation. It's how much of an invitation one can make into the rest of that process. That if there's the possibility, it's not that it should be not. It's not that one should avoid having something be complex, you know, because I also don't want to assume that an audience is stupid, and I think that always produces really bad, you know, very didactic sort of problematic work. But that to make sure that complexity is open in a way, you know. So I think that I would hope, or my hope for it is that the level of engagement is open as far as someone wants to go. But there's a certain kind of, like, my relationship to aspirin, like, I don't want to know how it's made, and I don't really care. But that if I wanted to get invested in the complexities of the process, that could be there, and that was also part of, you know, the coming to the work. So that you could just put it over a couch, or you could get involved in what drives my work, which is is more than just if it looks good with a couch, but it's other historical and political questions around art objects. So. I hope for, and it's the thing that I think I learned or started to really, that got me involved with Saul LeWitt in particular, that it seemed like you could go as far as you wanted. You could just treat it like a beautiful pattern, and that was fine, and the work accepted that, but you could also get involved with what historical debate he was involved with, how the precision of the practice, if you wanted to go that far, and it seemed totally generous to any kind of engagement that you wanted to sort of start. And I think he was brilliant at that, you know, and I don't think a lot of, you know, there's not tons of brilliance everywhere. But.
Uh,
I really enjoy how open your work is and how it exposes how many people and things are involved in the process of getting an object into a museum and being recognized as an art object. And I especially love the portraits and how they show all the different types of people, from critics, curators, collectors, and to the FedEx people. I was wondering if you ever considered taking, or if you have taken, portraits of visitors and their interaction with the work, and how important, I guess, the visitor is, because art wouldn't really exist without an audience.
I hadn't, because I don't, I've only, you know, in a sense, the portraits were, I mean, started with direct relationships that I had through my work with other individuals. So it, because the reciprocal, like, for example, like we were talking about the photograph of Russ, who is the securities, what's his proper title?
Safety officer
of the Smithsonian. And he, you know, we talked a lot through the course of the exhibition, so I took a portrait of him because there was a kind of engagement and a give and take, and I actually got a lot out of the discussion, and he affected, you know, I mean, both through the standards that you know, the ADA standards that he sort of communicated, but also, like, his discussion with me, like, he affected the work in some way that, I can't say exactly how or in what sense, but that it was important that engagement was documented for me. And with visitors, my only hesitation about that would be that it would have to involve that kind of give and take, and it would be in a different type of context. Whereas, like, an exhibition at a museum doesn't allow for that kind of contact, but I think it would be interesting. Does that make sense? You know, because it also should happen over some time, and that there should be a kind of discussion and things like that. So in a sense, there's not that opportunity for visitors to be as involved, and maybe they should. I don't know.
Like you said, it's about how it inflects on the work, and, yeah, and not just this idea that everybody's involved in creation of the meaning of the work, but it's the specific, yeah, inflections upon it.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for coming. We appreciate your coming today.